Hello, I'm Jason, and this is episode 9 of my podcast here at pointsinfocus.com, and we're going to start this podcast off with a quick update on my plans for content on the site for basically until January. So I started this year out with a plan. My plan was I wanted to put up content reliably on a weekly basis without huge gaps. And since the end of March, I have accomplished that. So 6 months, which truthfully is the longest stretch I've managed to put out content regularly on a weekly basis since basically I started writing for this site. And, you know, I'm happy to have accomplished that, but I always knew going into this thing that when the fall came around, that there was going to be some limitations to the, you know, that whole plan of content on a weekly basis. And we're here. And so there's going to be some cutting back for the time being on content. And there's a sort of a twofold reason for this. First of all is I'm about to start getting, I'm about to start having a lot of other distractions. I'm going to be going out west soon to do photography for a couple of weeks. I'm going to be spending some time with my family. Then the holidays show up and it's even more time doing stuff with the family and so on and so forth. And so there's a lot of, distraction isn't the right word. There's a lot of balancing of other priorities with the priorities of the site. That kind of cuts down my available time to work. On top of that, the way I do content is basically anytime I have an idea, I write it down on a sticky note and stick it up on a board on my wall. And every time I get an article done, unless there's something extremely topical that I'm going to go into next, I go to the wall and I look at the sticky notes and I pick the next sticky note that I am interested in working on or that I think I can get done in time or so forth for content for the site. And the sort of byproduct of having the goal of putting up an article a week, basically I was self-selecting for the shorter, easier, or at least the shorter to produce articles that I had in line for my site for the content. So basically what's left on my board now are articles that take 2 or 3 or 4 weeks or more to write. And, you know, it's time to start digging into those. And I guess maybe if I had some more forethought in the whole thing, then I could have done, you know, interweaved those with shorter articles so that I always had stuff going and I was kind of working through them. But I didn't, so I didn't do that. And at this point, with some of the articles, in my experience, especially camera reviews, so I have two camera reviews planned. I have the EOS M3 that I've already started working on a little, and I'm going to need to like get nose to the grindstone on that and finish it up. And then I've got a 5D Mark IV coming in the near future, so there's going to be a review for that, probably sometime in November, December, maybe, depending on how quickly I can work through all of the material. Although, that said, I wrote a camera review for the 5D Mark III a couple of years ago, and it was 25,000 words, and it was 3 40-hour weeks of writing and editing and photography and testing and so on and so forth. So the 5D Mark IV is even more complicated as a camera, even though it doesn't maybe feel or seem that way. And to fully appreciate and understand the camera, to me, it's probably going to take more than 3 weeks of work to get to that. So, you know, those are kind of big things. I also have some projects that I'm looking at for testing. I want to look at rolling shutter. And I want to look at it in a controlled scientific way with a test rig. And I want to look and see how much tolerance there is or whatever to changes in speed for the how the minor changes in speed of the panning action, so to speak, affect the appearance of rolling shutter effect, which, I mean, that's something that I'm going to get into in the article, really. But to do that, I have to build a test rig. I have to test cameras. I have to do a lot of controlled tests for those cameras. And then, of course, collate the results and the data and put together an article and talk about what's going on and so forth. So most of the content that I have now is not stuff that, or most of the stuff on my project board now is stuff that's not a, 5 minute process or whatever. It's a 1 week kind of article or whatever. It's something that I'm going to have to work on, spend some time on. Now, I do have some content already kind of queued up, but that's sort of, another thing. The podcast, with the content, or for the last 10 weeks, basically my content has been a article and a podcast. And podcasts have, they're different than writing for me, at least. There's still a good amount of preparation that goes into them, but they're less formal. They don't require me to I don't feel that it's necessary for me to put quite as much effort into constructing a sentence that means exactly what I mean it to mean and revising to be perfect. They're usually less technical topics that I'm kind of going into, or I'm talking about technical topics less technically or whatever, but they tend to be a little easier for me to approach and accomplish. And so my thinking right now is that while the main articles may taper off, or at least not be a weekly thing until, January or something like that, that I'm going to try and keep the podcasts going at the podcast pace, at a podcast a week for, at least till, I'm hoping, mid-December. So with any kind of creative endeavor, there's always a level of burnout that I kind of think of it as like when you're not producing creative stuff, you're refilling the bucket of creative juices. And then when you go to produce something, you're siphoning creative juices out of that. And because of the way that kind of works for me, I end up needing to take a step away from stuff for a little while to refill and being reinvigorated and really get back to what it is that I wanted to do and talk about. So I was planning, or I've been planning, to take off, at least the second half of December and possibly some of November or something like that, 3 or 4 weeks from the podcast, and then come back and start, I'll call it season two, for lack of a better word, and, dig back right in and go from there. In addition to that, I'm, like I said, going to be traveling. I'm not sure I'm going to try and record a bunch of podcasts before I go. I might try recording a podcast on the road about wherever it is or whatever it is I'm doing out there and put that up. I don't know if I want to take all the audio gear for that, but it's something that I'm thinking possibly about doing. But I'm expecting potentially my plan right now is that for the couple of weeks that I'm not around, that for the, or not in the office, so to speak, I'm going to not have a podcast. And then I'll come back and I'll be talking about the American Southwest and the national parks and the Grand Canyon and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the short or the long of content on Points in Focus for, until January 2017. So from basically end of September to January of 2017. With that said, I want to talk about or go into talking a little bit about maybe, I don't want to call it the engineering, but maybe the whys or the hows or something on the engineering had thinking about the engineering or something to that effect about Canon camera video codecs. There's two things I want to prefix this with. First, I'm not a big video guy. There are people that do much more video than I do. I don't really do video all that much. I'm a still guy. I have a handle on most of the theory, but putting that into practice in a lot of cases is not something that I have a ton of practical experience with. Second of all, I hate talking about credentials because to me, every time somebody touts out credentials, it's kind of a appeal to their own perceived authority. And I hate that. I hate when anybody says, look at me, I'm a good photographer, you should listen to what I have to say. Your state, in my opinion, what you say should, you know, if you're going to put forward an argument or a thought process or give advice, your argument or thought process or advice should be able to stand on its own and not require you to say, I'm an XYZ to you know, make that happen. However, on the same token, you know, this is a podcast. It's basically on the internet. And the thing with everything on the internet is everybody's an expert. And, you know, I have to give serious props to Art Wolf. He is one of the very few photographers that I've, you know, big name photographers that I've interacted with directly, that when people would ask him technical questions, he would basically say, I'm an artist. I understand the camera well enough to get the pictures I want. And I don't really have an answer to that, and I don't know. And to me, given the fact that I've seen so many other big-name photographers that basically try and answer technical questions that they clearly are in over their head on, in my opinion, I don't, you know, I want to draw a line on that. So I don't have an art degree. I have a bachelor's in computer engineering. That was my college education, was on computer engineering. So electronics, the physics and stuff behind silicon, how chips are built and programmed and works and that kind of thing. Photography's always been an interest of mine, and it just happens to be the one that I'm pursuing vigorously or have pursued vigorously since graduating, but my formal education is in computer engineering. Prior to going to college, I had the fortune to work for an electrical engineering firm, and not a computer, or not an electronics one, but an actual like power firm that they did photometrics. They did, you know, like lighting design for parking lots and sports fields and that kind of thing, among other things, but it was that kind of scale work. And that, while it doesn't give me much of an appreciation for electronic stuff, it gives me appreciation for the bureaucracy around actual projects, internally, externally. A project that I may have worked on as a draftsman, I mean, admittedly, I was only doing drafting. I wasn't doing engineering in high school. But a project that I worked on as a draftsman at the beginning of one summer might not get completed till the end of the next summer. You know, by the time it goes through all the permitting, and then it started, like, the client that wanted something done was putting out request for proposals, RFPs, or contacting the you know, engineers or architects or the develop design teams, you know, before I even was looking at things, because, or doing drafting work, because the project doesn't start with drafting. The project starts with somebody saying, I want something. And then, you know, if it's like a parking lot, the lighting is kind of the last thing in some respects. Somebody comes in and designs the parking lot. And, you know, if it's a shopping center or something like that, they design the shopping center and then they situate that on the lot. And then they put the parking lot around it. And then the electrical comes in and, you know, the lighting and all of that stuff gets done sort of on top of after that. So what my point here, though, is that, like, most of my background is in engineering. So I don't want you to take my word that when I say something that X is the way it is, because you know, again, I'm not an expert in electronics. I'm not an expert in camera design. I'm not an expert in building silicon chips. I have a bachelor's level degree, college education in that kind of stuff. I never pursued that professionally. So, you know, I've done electronics work, you know, hobbyist level, but I've never pursued the silicon chip design, circuit work, that kind of thing professionally. So this isn't an expert's opinion in the field. This is a slightly informed person's take on things. But there's a lot of parallels between like what I experienced as a draftsman and, you know, working and looking at the stuff on a power, you know, macro scale level compared to what goes into designing a consumer electronic project or product. They're not the same. The details are certainly different. But for instance, when you build a building, you go through permitting, and there's requirements, and the governing body, the city or the town or the county or whatever, you submit plans and they review the plans to make sure that the plans meet the requirements that are in the codes and so forth. And then usually a lot of times you get the plans back and you have to make adjustments or corrections for something that the permitting people didn't like, and so on and so forth. Now, in a camera, you don't have to get a permit to build the camera per se, but there's all kinds of certifications that have to be passed to sell the product to market. The big one, or a big one, is the FCC in the United States. The EU has their own, I think it's the EC, standards body. But the FCC governs radio transmission stuff. Anything that has an oscillating electrical current produces a radio wave, and therefore has the potential to be a radio transmitting source. And of course, you know, cameras have tons of those in them. Every signal trace on the board, the fact that the processor is running at gigahertz speeds or hundreds of megahertz speeds at least, the traces from the sensor to the processor, you know, transmit signals from the processor to the DDR memory modules, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so all consumer electronic devices are required to be certified by, in the US, it's the FCC. In Europe, that's, I think, the EC. In Japan, there's a board. The China has their own thing. I think Canada has their own thing. Japan has their own thing. Russia has their own thing. So there's all these certification bodies. And every place that they want to sell a camera, they have to have the certification to sell it there, or to a certification that country considers equivalent to their own certification. So, and to get these certifications, they have to send the camera off to a lab to have it tested. And the lab tests the camera to make sure that it's not going to, you know, interfere with weather radar for airplanes or something like that. And so there's, while it's not a submit plans and have somebody say, well, we don't like where you put the fire alarm or something like that, or your light's too close to the street or something to that effect, they build a product, they submit a product, it gets tested. Most of the time, I suspect that the testing, you know, comes back that there aren't any problems. But I could be wrong. You can look at a lot of Kickstarter projects that have had to go through this kind of testing to see what they have happened to them. But for a product like a camera or something, I suspect that Canon has enough internal development experience and whatnot to not have to, you know, take the camera back and rebuild or redesign something. But that's still a possibility. Beyond the standards bodies, or the government certification bodies, there's standards bodies for all kinds of different things. Like a modern DSLR has a USB port, it has an HDMI port, it has a SD card slot, has a compact flash slot or a CFast slot or an XQD slot. all of those things are governed by various standards bodies. And so for you to have a USB port on your camera and slap the logo on and say, this is a USB port, it has to be tested to conform, ensure that it conforms, or that the implementation has to conform to the USB special interest group's standards. There's a testing procedure for that. It's not, you know, a huge rigor, or it's not a huge impediment to anything, but that has to be validated. The if you're designing, so Canon and Nikon and Sony, everybody's, you know, probably familiar with the whole, you know, Canon has Digic, Sony has or Nikon has X-Speed, Sony has Bions, you know, and they make a big deal out of the, you know, Digic 6 plus, minus, plus, plus, whatever, you know, or the X-Speed 9 or, you know, whatever Nikon's up to on numbers. Those are systems on a chip, and you can think of those basically like the CPU in your computer, which most people don't think about at all, or the CPU in your phone, which it's actually probably more analogous to than not than the CPU in your computer. But these are bespoke, relatively bespoke parts that each of these companies are producing. It's not a, you know, we're going to go buy a Qualcomm regular cell phone CPU and slap it in our camera and that's it. It's got parts of it that are licensed from, say, like the CPU cores, and most of these are ARM cores, which is similar to like what Apple uses. It's the same instruction set. The microarchitecture is going to be different, but it's the same basic instruction set as like what Apple uses in the iPhone, or is used in all the Android phones and tablets and so on and so forth. But it's a bespoke part that Canon or Nikon make. And part of that is because they have to throw in or put in little bits of things that the camera needs to work properly, efficiently. That isn't necessarily what you're going to have, or what you would have in a off-the-shelf part. And all of this has to be validated, again, because it's a CPU, it's a, you know, a processor, it has to do things, it has to perform things properly. You know, if you're old enough to remember the late 90s Pentium division bug, where Intel's Pentium 60 processors didn't divide proper, you know, didn't perform certain division operations properly, that, you know, you don't want that happening on a camera when it's the, you know, autofocus system or whatever, that you want the autofocus system to work correctly. So there's a lag time and stuff in all of this that Canon, Nikon, Sony, they don't just go, oh, we need a camera. And of course, I completely missed the 8,000-pound gorilla in the room, the sensor. Most of the sensors in cell phones aren't bespoke parts. They're Apple orders a sensor from Sony or somebody, or, you know, says we want these performance characteristics, and on Semiconductor or DALSA or Sony or any of the, you know, people who make sensors that are frequently used in like cell phones or whatever, have the ability to quickly throw that together based on, you know, well, we have an existing 12 megapixel sensor and we need this lens assembly or something to that effect. There's customization, but it's not like we're going to start from scratch and build a sensor, you know, pixel by pixel at the silicon level. The company that makes the sensors is doing that, but they're doing that in parallel, and at the same time, they're doing that across a broader product range than, you know, just a given phone. And, you know, of course, it's going to vary bit by bit. Apple may have more bespoke parts than, say, Samsung or something like that. But my point here is that, like, Canon, Nikon, Sony, et cetera, their sensors are super bespoke for what they're doing. And so there's a whole bunch of R&D that goes into how do we build this thing, and then there's a whole bunch of R&D that, you know, from an architectural point, and there's a whole bunch of R&D that goes into how do we actually build this thing, because, for example, Canon builds their own sensors. I believe actually it's built, they're built in a foundry in a partnership with Mitsubishi Heavy Industries or something like that. At least that's what I think I read a while ago. But the they have all of the problems of figuring out how to make this come out in a working product. Admittedly, they're using very old, as far as like super high-end process goes, technologies. Most of, not all of the camera companies are building their sensors on design rules that were state-of-the-art in like the late 90s. So there's a lot of things that are solved problems, but there's a lot of things that become slightly different problems because, well, they're not building a CPU, they're building an image sensor. But anyway, there's a lot of lead time on this stuff. And so the first kind of point I wanted, why I'm bringing this up, is I see so many people in online making comments that are going like, you know, that why aren't they reacting this to this or that or the next thing? And, you know, Nikon came out with a camera that does X, and why didn't Canon, you know, isn't Canon doing that yet? Well, Canon's not doing that because Canon, the camera, like the 5D Mark IV that we're just about to start see shipping, well, it'll be shipping the day this podcast publishes, that the 5D Mark IV that we're just about to start see shipping started development probably 2 or 3 years ago. And it takes that, would take about that long, I think, best guess, based on, you know, what I've read about camera design and whatnot, that it would take about that long for the R&D and all of the engineering and testing and production for, you know, factory production gearing up. Because, I mean, remember, this is stuff that has to be produced. So not only do you have to design the camera, but you have to make sure that the tooling is in place to build the camera, or in some cases, design the tooling to build the design and build the tooling to build the camera. So it's not like there's it's not something that can be just, oh, look at somebody did something, change direction. That, you know, when you see a big change in direction, and I've said this in the past, but a big change in direction, Canon video and the cinema stuff, and the 5D Mark II went on sale and became a massive hit and success, and Canon went and looked at it and went, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in this video stuff if we just start tapping our resources to do video stuff. And then right after that, you saw like a whole bunch of cameras that reused the same sensor in the crop space and not a lot going on in full frame. And then all of a sudden there was Cinema EOS cameras and the new full frame sensors and so on and so forth. And while this was happening, I mean, so one of the big complaints that always gets made leveled against Canon is that they don't have the dynamic range that Sony has. And while Sony was making revision after revision, or Nikon, because Nikon and Sony have a partnership, or had a partnership, I'm not sure if it still exists, in the sensor design and tech, that while Canon was making this big sort of about face that took several years to implement and do, Nikon and Sony were working through revisions and revision after revision of sensors with on-chip ADCs and optimized better, you know, noise performance and so on and so forth. And what we're seeing now with the 1DX Mark II, the 5D Mark IV, and the 80D are Canon's first generation on-chip ADC sensors that are, you know, as people would love to point out, that are 6 years old or 6 years too late, or it, well, people say they're 6 years too late, but the reality is Canon's been making money on their media or imaging division that for the past 6 years. So they're obviously not 6 years too late, or Canon would have been out of business or borderline out of business. But they're 6 years late from, you know, where Sony was. And that's the sort of, that's the knock-on effect of, you know, people don't talk about it, but that's the knock-on effect of, oh, we need to make this major change in direction. They make a major change in direction and now have to sort of correct back to the normal flow of things. That my guess, and I, you know, I can't be sure about this at all, but my guess is that if Canon hadn't had been wildly successful with the 5D Mark II for video, that we would have seen a wildly different 5D Mark III. It probably would have had on-chip ADCs. It probably would have been pushing the dynamic range performance that Sony and Nikon were, you know, were very close to at the time, because as the story goes, at least that I've been, you know, I've seen online, when Canon Japan came over to talk to the Canon America people, the Canon America salespeople, about the 5D Mark II, the whole video was like an afterthought. It was like they were closing up, the meeting was over, and the guys went, oh, by the way, it shoots 1080p high def video. And everybody in the, you know, all the American salespeople were like, what? And the Nikon Japan, or the Canon Japan people were like, yeah, it shoots video. And it's kind of, you know, it was just something we threw in. And to me, that indicates that Canon really didn't understand the landmine that they were stepping on and where things were going to go. And then the whole post that is just a massive reaction to try and capture that and not, you know, but anyway, my point here is that camera design takes a long time. It's not something that gets done overnight. As a sort of tangent to that too, and, you know, going back to what I was saying about engineering and whatnot, there's also, so a company like Canon almost certainly doesn't have one team working on cameras. They'll have multiple teams. And all of these projects have deadlines and milestones and points where they have to freeze work and test, or freeze work and debug, or freeze work and ship the product to manufacturing, or it goes to the next phase. And the reason I'm bringing this up is, it's sort of, like I said, tangential to the whole thing, is the 5D Mark IV has dual pixel RAW, or a dual pixel RAW format. And it's only like 6 months after the 1DX Mark II. So, you know, why wouldn't the 1DX Mark II have that? Well, a very good reason to that is it wasn't developed by the 1DX team. And the 1DX team was already feature frozen before the 5D team came up with this and had it in a state where it could be implemented. And so it just doesn't happen. A perfect example of this, this is an even better example. The 40D and the 1DX Mark III, another like sort of, you know, perfect example of this kind of disparity is the EOS 40D and the EOS 1D Mark III. The Mark III was released or announced in February of 2007. The 40D was announced in August of 2007. And the 40D has a feature where when the camera's in live mode, you can hit the AF on button and it will snap the mirror down and it will autofocus. And that feature doesn't exist on the 1D Mark III. And it's a really simple feature when you stop and think about it. It's probably, you know, maybe a dozen lines of code at most to make this happen, and it's just not there. And so anyway, there's one aspect of this is it takes time to design and integrate a camera and build a camera. It takes even more time if you're trying to redesign a system on a chip to do something sort of radically different or new. So, like I said, the thing I wanted to talk about was video codecs and why the Canon may have done what they did with Motion JPEG for 4K and H.264 for 1080p. And, you know, again, like I said, what it got me kind of going on this was the number of places I've seen on discussion forums where people were just railing at how stupid Canon is for doing Motion JPEG for 4K video, and it, you know, it should have H.264 like everybody else does, blah blah blah. And before I kind of go in technical thing side on this, I want to just kind of point out, first of all, like, isn't that kind of backwards? Well, not backwards, but like, isn't that the wrong kind of argument that you want to make? H.264, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's a really good codec for making a small file, but It does that because it throws away a lot of information. It does both spatial and temporal compression. It does psychovisual analysis to get rid of information that you don't need and or that you aren't going to see, but that might actually be relevant for post-processing. It's a heavily lossy codec. It's great for deliverables because you get a small file. It's great for something like streaming video over the internet because you get, again, a small file. But as the kind of thing that you're capturing in, you're in a lot of ways shooting yourself in the foot to get started to have a small file because that's what it was designed to do. And it seems to me like if you want to make an argument for faulting Canon for doing something with the 4K or whatever, that the argument should be, why didn't they go ProRes or DNxHD? Why didn't they go to an actual professional capture format? Something that, you know, has serious image quality options at very relatively good compression levels and does it in a format that's very friendly to editing. That, you know, H.264 isn't that friendly to editing because of the whole temporal component. It requires H.264 isn't that friendly, period. All of that compression that you get to make the file small comes because it throws a lot of complicated math and processing at the problem of making the file small. And ultimately, that's a problem because, I mean, if you take, for example, I have a relatively old, but it's not entirely a slouch of a desktop computer. It's an overclocked Intel Core i5-2500K running at 4.2 gigahertz. So it's not super competitive in terms of like the top end of a modern, you know, current state-of-the-art Intel system, but it's within like 10% of that. And that running a software, running X264, which is one of the best software, if not the best software in terms of quality and speed, software H.264 codecs, can barely keep up with taking Blu-ray class source material down to PDA class source material in real time. So it's not doing it at 20, you know, it's barely doing it, I should say, at 24 frames a second. A lot of times it's doing it like 15 frames a second. Well, a camera can't do slower than real time compression, and a camera doesn't have almost 100 watts of thermal budget to work with in an infinite power supply provided by the local power company. That in a 5D, you have like 26 to 30 watt hours of power total in the camera from batteries, and you have thermal limits that things get hot and the camera has to operate within those thermal limits, and it has to operate well enough within those thermal limits, which there's a whole nother engineering topic. For example, the 5D Mark IV is designed to operate from 32 to 105 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 0 to 40 degrees centigrade. That is my understanding is the ambient temperature of where the camera is, but the camera potentially inside is going to be a lot hotter. I mean, I did an experiment. Well, it wasn't really an experiment. It was just I was messing around, and I have Magic Lantern installed on my 5D, and taking it out of a drawer in my 78 degree office and turning it on and going through some settings for not that long and finding that, hey, it can measure the temperature of the sensor. And the temperature in the camera after not that long was like 95 degrees. That's kind of, you know, that's a pretty good bump. And it's not like, you know, I brought the camera in from a 95 degree day outside and then did this like 10 minutes later. This was sitting in the drawer where I keep it for at least a day. It was fully acclimated to the temperature of the room at like 78 degrees. And so, you know, you can imagine, and I mean, I tell people that, you know, my experience back when I was doing like a lot of bird photography is I could look at pictures that I shot and tell you not necessarily like within 10 degrees how hot it was, but that this picture was taken when it was warmer than this picture. And I could do it purely based on the noise, because as the camera was in the sun and the camera got hot, the pictures got noisier. And because I was shooting so much with the camera in such, you know, in with similar content and similar scenarios and settings, I could see, I was very familiar with what the output would be, and I could see the noise characteristics changing. And so that's a real concern, because as the camera gets hotter, the sensor gets noisier, and as the sensor gets noisier, the image quality degrades. And any good camera company worth their salt is going to, you know, try to ensure that their system provides adequate quality images or good quality images throughout, you know, the entire temperature range they design it to, carrying in mind that, you know, it's a black camera, and if it's out in the sun and you're taking pictures, you know, on the field at a football stadium and it's 95 out, but you're in the sun, that your camera is going to be considerably hotter than 95 potentially, because it's black and it, you know, absorbs heat. And, you know, so there's, that's an aspect. And that, following that, like the camera absorbing heat, when you throw more heat into the mixture from the CPU, well, first of all, you have the whole heat of the CPU thing that, you know, it's a long way from 100 degrees Fahrenheit to silicon failing, basically. But that CPU is putting more heat into the system, possibly more heat than the system's readily dissipating. And that's going to further degrade the image quality. And, you know, obviously, again, the whole point here is to have good image quality. At least that's my whole point of having a camera, is, you know, to have good image quality. So you've got that going on. Then you've got, so that's sort of one aspect of why something may go the other way. H.264, even if you're doing it in hardware, is still computationally more complex than potentially JPEG compression is, especially if you're doing that in hardware, which in the case of Canon cameras, both are being done in hardware. But there's another problem, the hardware. The H.264 has all kinds of profiles and levels and tweaks and handles and turns and knobs. And not every tweak and handle and turn and knob is going to be implemented in every given decoder or encoder hardware. A perfect example of this, iPads, iPhones. As far as I know, they don't support decoding high 10p, which is the 10-bit profile in H.264. Either they have to do that in software, in which case your battery goes out the window, or they just don't play. Unfortunately, I don't have any high 10p content to play around or to test that with before I was recording this, so I'm not entirely sure how that behaves. But even like decoders, you know, not so much now on current like iPads or iPhones, but, you know, some years ago, if you had H.264 content that was encoded in level 4.2 or higher or something like that, it didn't work on the device in hardware, because the device couldn't handle that bit stream or that bit, the bit depth that, the bit rate that entailed and the processing that entailed. And the same thing is true like on a camera. So one thing that I haven't seen a lot of people talking about, well, they're railing about how Canon did this horrible thing with motion JPEG and blah, 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 is that 4K on the Canon on the 5D Mark II in motion JPEG is 422 chroma subsampled. I'm not going to get into chroma subsampling. If you're a video guy, you know what I'm talking about. If you're not a video guy, there's a good Wikipedia page. I'll put a link in the show notes that the, from a post-production standpoint, as far as I understand things, you want more finely grained chroma subsampling. So most H.264 content, if not the, like, and I mean by most, I mean like the vast majority, all of the content produced by Nikon cameras or Sony cameras is internally is 420 chroma subsampled. Again, look it up on Wikipedia. You'll understand. It does a better job than I can explain in a podcast. But basically what it means is you're not sampling chroma information as often because you're throwing, well, essentially without going into all of the details of chroma subsampling, the way our eyes work as people is we are less sensitive to chroma information, so color, as we are luma information or brightness differences. And so what people have found in smart people, way smarter than me, in designing video stuff, is you could save a lot of space by getting rid of the, you know, by not having the same density of chroma information or luma chroma information as you had luma information. So 4K video is 8.8 megapixels. So you have 8.8 megapixels of luma information, but maybe you only have 4 megapixels of each of the two chroma channels, as opposed to having 8 megapixels, 3 times 8 megapixels for each of the luma and two chroma channels. So you can see right away, if you're not sampling the chroma information as frequently, then you are having to deal with saving less data, and therefore your file sizes are smaller. So, you know, hooray or whatever. But when you get to doing things like, for example, chroma keying, that non-sampled chroma information has an effect on the ability to isolate the edge of an image. And so 420 chroma subsampling is generally fine for playback, for deliverable, for people watching it. It's what the vast majority of H.264 content that we see on the web, on like YouTube or something like that, it's what the vast majority of H.264 content is, period, but it's vast majority of like what you get on TV, etc. But for processing, for color grading, for doing visual effects, for doing even like just simple things like chroma keying and so forth, that information is kind of important. And so you want generally a finer chroma subsampling, which is where the 422 chroma subsampling comes in. It's higher resolution chroma information compared to 420. The deal, though, is, like I said, now there is a profile in H.264 that supports 422 chroma subsampling. There's also one that supports 444 chroma subsampling, which means that it samples luma and 2 chroma at every pixel, which would be, you know, the ideal. I mean, ideally, if you were going to do H.264 compression as a production video capture thing, then you would want 444. It's high 444p, that profile. High 422p would probably be an acceptable second choice. But again, the thing though is, because that is so rare, and it is rare in H.264 content, because that is so rare, there isn't a lot, as far as I can tell, of hardware modules, you know, the intellectual property to put in your chip that can compress that. So, because, I mean, and this happens because most of that, the hardware H.264 compression stuff is going to, you know, like cell phone manufacturers, that they don't care that it's 420 chroma subsampled. The camera isn't important. No matter what Apple says about how important or how awesome the camera is in their phone, it isn't that important. They're not, you know, doing broadcast TV work with it. At the same time, you know, that the lack of development work or whatever would mean that Canon would have to implement something from scratch, which of course would take a long time and cost a lot of money and, you know, so on and so forth. MJPEG, on the other hand, right out the gate, JPEG is not, you know, getting 422 JPEG is not a big deal. It's easily done through most hardware JPEG compression stuff, just filtering it off. And the side effect, sort of, is that Canon's Motion JPEG is 422 chroma subsampled. So, like I said, what I don't see a lot of people talking about when they're talking about how, oh, you know, that we should have had H.264, wham, 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 Motion JPEG is old, is, but you're getting a 422 chroma subsampled all eye, or, you know, every frame stands alone, basically, codec versus getting a 420 chroma subsampled codec that can be all live, but not always is used that way. So there's, you know, given the fact that, so there's like, I guess there's two reasons that Canon could have done what they did. One reason is that they didn't have the hardware or the license for the hardware or the licensed functional unit to put in their system on a chip that could support 4K at whatever bit rate they wanted to use. I think they'd need at least level 5.2 or something, 5.1, so on and so forth. Because, I mean, obviously, you can get hardware to do it because Sony and Nikon do that. Another line of argument or reason is that potentially the performance, the thermal properties or whatever, because remember, it's still, even though it's in hardware and it's much more efficient than doing it in software on a general purpose CPU, that the hardware still has to do the processing. There's still a significant amount of computation being done, and therefore there's going to be some heat production. The hardware that they could have just didn't meet the thermal requirements. Turns out JPEG compression, especially in hardware, seems to be a little less demanding of power and processing. Of course, the side effect is that while it's less demanding of power and processing resources, it's not as good of a compression rate, so it has to have more bits, essentially, to get the same quality. There is a third point, though, which that it was a deliberate design objective in that if they did 422 H.264, so H.264 high 422p, and let's say they had the hardware, they would have a problem, namely playback. The vast majority of devices like tablets and whatnot that can do real-time decoding of H.264, including videos or video cards and the acceleration stuff that's like in Intel processors and stuff like that, I don't believe can accelerate high 422p. It can accelerate 422 profiles, but not the 422 profiles, in part because the 422 profile requires, I think, 10 bits per sample versus the 420s, which are 8 bits per sample. And that pushes sort of a potential issue, if you will, in that if you go and shoot something on your DSLR and you are assuming that it's just a regular old H.264 file and you go play it back on your computer, it doesn't play back properly or it doesn't play back smoothly, or you put it on your tablet and you go to play it back and it doesn't play back at all because the tablet doesn't support the profile. I will have to look into this. That's another good thing to put on my list for content. That could be a problem in just in terms of, and then all of a sudden people start going, well, the files are broken. Well, maybe they're not broken. Maybe it's just not supported by playing back on your tablet or phone or whatever. Or on the camera. Remember, the camera has to play it back on, when you're doing review. So it has to have the decoder hardware just the same as it has to have the encoder hardware. But then there's another sort of line of reasoning here, too, which potentially, going with the design thing, where Canon has gone with their 4K, they are the only consumer camera manufacturer, and I'm saying consumer as opposed to, like, professional videographer or whatever. I wouldn't call the 5D a consumer camera, I'd call it a professional camera, but, compared to an Alpha A7S II or a Nikon D5, Canon is the only one of those three companies who isn't doing Ultra HD. They're doing DCI 4K. And the difference is like 100 and something pixels. The DCI 4K is a 4096 pixel wide field or frame. Ultra HD is 3840 pixels wide, 3840 pixels wide. The difference is where these two things show up. Ultra HD is the consumer standard. It's what TVs are being built to. It's what it's what computer monitors are being built to on the same resolution grounds as TVs. DCI 4K is the cinema standard. And so, you know, it's not that you can't use the potentially can't use a simple H.264 encoder hardware-wise for cinema standards, you know, or the DCI 4K frame, but the fact that you have these problems with 422 chroma subsampling and the fact that you have Canon apparently looking at the cinema standard as their frame size, it raises the question that maybe the choice was deliberate on the grounds that it was the best way to get 422 chroma subsampling, which, again, is desirable if you're doing visual effects work. And, again, I'm speculating here, but to me, it doesn't seem like this is all that cut and dry of a question or a complaint. That I don't think Canon is stupidly doing something wrong because they're not doing H.264. Like I said, personally, I would like to see them not doing H.264 at all. I would really like, I mean, well, I shouldn't say at all. There's a lot of times where that's all I really want. That's all I really need. I don't want, you know, 60 gigabyte files or something like that. But if I'm going to, you know, complain about compression options, you know, I want ProRes. That I want 422 ProRes. That right out of the camera, I want to be able to stick a flash card in and record 422 ProRes and drag that, take that right in and edit that. That seems to me like the far more impressive or not impressive, far more well thought out argument than whining about it not being H.264. But then again, like I said, I'm not an expert on building camera hardware and I'm not an expert in video. So, you know, maybe I'm just entirely wrong and, you know, we don't, serious video people really don't want ProRes and H.264 is where it's at. Or possibility also exists that all the people that are railing about how it doesn't do H.264 on message boards across the internet, or how Canon isn't doing H.264 and 4K across message boards on the internet, really don't know what they're talking about. That I'm not sure. And I'm going to let you decide on that one. And with that said, I'm going to wrap this up. And until next time.